Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Supporters of Italy's flamboyant Prime Minister, billionaire Silvio Berlusconi, are calling for a recount. The results in the Italian election appears to give center-left challenger Romano Prodi a narrow majority and a race so razor close it could affect the winner's ability to govern. What are the ramifications of Italy's dramatic vote? Tracy Wilkinson is Rome bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us now from Rome. And Tracy, first of all, is this a surprise that it's so close?
We knew it would be close, but I don't think we expected it to be this close, where literally we aren't 100% sure of what the result is, and we have still one side refusing to acknowledge the results that the other side is convinced are in play. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it is surprising that it's been this close.
Well, here in the U.S., we know Berlusconi, Italy's richest man, a huge, powerful ally of George Bush. His business empire includes television stations, newspapers, a soccer team. But who is Prodi?
Prodi is, in many ways, the opposite of Berlusconi, where Berlusconi is flamboyant and kind of wild. Prodi is very conservative, not politically, but conservative in terms of his personality, his demeanor. He's an economics professor and very much comes off as one. He's sometimes called by the Italian press the parish priest, and that's not really meant as a compliment. It's more of a reflection of just how mild-mannered he generally is.
What does it reflect that so many Italians voted for him?
A lot of Italians were very disillusioned with where the economy has gone in the last 5 years under Berlusconi. Berlusconi came to power promising to reform the economy, to use the kind of business acumen that he had so aptly applied to his own interests and properties and holdings to the country, to run the country like a business and spread prosperity everywhere. That didn't happen, and a lot of Italians were tired of listening to promises from him that they felt he did not keep. There were a few other issues. Some people found his Berlusconi's style just to be a little over the top and too much. Although that said, a lot of Italians like it. So definitely the country is split on that score. Right. But it's mainly a reaction to the economy, I think, that had people voting for the left, for Prodi and his coalition.
Well, and getting back to how much people just seem to like Berlusconi, you write that one voter told you he voted for Berlusconi because he loved him and compared it to being in love with a criminal. And that brings the question, is it true that Silvio Berlusconi, in just the days before the election, made phone calls to sex phone lines, and he said it was to do research?
Yes, apparently so. That was widely reported here. He said one night he had nothing to do, and so he started dialing some of these sex phone lines to ask the women how they were going to vote.
So there you go.
That's the kind of outrageous thing he will say, and frankly, a lot of Italians love it.
Yeah. Well, no matter who the winner is, you write that it seems there's a danger of Italy's government stuck in gridlock because neither man will have a clear mandate. What will that mean for Italy, and what will that mean for how long either man gets to govern?
It could be very problematic. Italy does need some major structural reforms in its economy and aspects of its political system, taxation, et cetera. And a leader would need to have a strong majority to be able to push those reforms through, because they will be painful in some respects. And so if neither side has a mandate, and I think that's clear, then it will be very difficult to legislate anything at all controversial. It would also mean that the length of the government is not insured. Berlusconi, by lasting 5 years, was the longest serving prime minister since World War II in Italy, and other governments in Italy tend to fall after a few years, and I think we might see that again.
Tracy Wilkinson, Rome bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times, speaking from Rome. One last question. If Prodi does win and Berlusconi is out, how is that expected to change Italy's relationship with the U.S.? We mentioned Berlusconi, one of President Bush's staunchest European allies.
Berlusconi reversed the traditional alliance that Italy had with its European neighbors and focused almost exclusively on Washington, and as well as London and Moscow and even Israel. Prodi is much more of a European. He would, while not turning his back on Washington, he would tend to look first to Europe.
Tracy, thank you.
Thank you.
Yet another attempt to end the conflict in Sudan's Darfur region has met with failure. Meetings in the Nigerian capital of Abuja with representatives of the African Union, the Sudanese government, and rebels ended without an agreement for a ceasefire. And while the world's attention has been focused sporadically on Darfur, another crisis is eating at the very soul of Africa. The five-year crisis in Congo has already killed 4 million people, mostly from war-induced sickness and hunger. The conflict has drawn in 7 armies from other African countries and created an ugly network of militias which butcher and sometimes cannibalize their victims, and street gangs, including one made up of amputees in wheelchairs and hand-pedaled carts, a mass of shiny steel like freaky Hell's Angels. That last description comes from Brian Mueller, who reported from Congo until last fall. His article, Congo's Daily Blood, Ruminations from a Failed State, appears in the recent issue of Harper's Magazine. And Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
How's it going? Thank you very much.
Let's start at the beginning. Remind us, where is Congo? What are the border states?
Congo takes up the large part of the heart of Africa. On the east, you have Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi bordering it. On the south, you have Angola, and it juts out into the western part of Congo, hits the Atlantic Ocean.
Right. And this would seem to be part of the problem in that it's bordered by many troubled countries and, you know,
Sudan being one as well.
And so a lot of the militias and refugees from these other countries then pour into Congo.
That's right.
Yeah. And what are the politics, briefly, of Congo that allow all these other groups to come in? What brought Congo to this point?
Well, basically, Congo's problem started with its dictator, Mobutu Sese Seko, who ruled for decades and really let a centralized government kind of go to waste, let it slip away. You bring the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, which sparked most of the conflict now. You had Hutu rebels streaming over in from Rwanda. They settled in the eastern part of Congo. Rwanda invaded in 97, under the auspices of cleaning out these rebels. When they invaded, Uganda invaded, Angola invaded, Zimbabwe, and then you had many countries in Congo at once. This war lasted from roughly, 97, 98 until 2003. And right now, a lot of those militias are, while the big armies have left, a lot of their kind of de facto little militias are still left. And they, loot and destroy and rape and pillage the land, for mineral deposits that are really great in Congo. So.
And as you write, there's no ability to control them because there's been decades of corruption, dirty politics. No infrastructure. This is a country 3 times the size of Texas, no roads, electricity. And it just feels as if it's at least in your writing, a completely non-functioning country.
Yeah, it sort of is. In Kinshasa, you have a government, and the government is slowly trying to clean itself up. The international community has stepped in heavily. Congo is the largest UN peacekeeping mission in the world. With some 16,700 peacekeeping troops, plus, the various agencies that go involved into, trying to pick up a state from its bootstraps. And yet in the east, it's like it's a different country, and the war still carries on there. The massacres and the attacks in these villages still carry on a daily basis. And in the east is where you have the most displaced populations. You have some 2 million people who are displaced at one time in Congo. And as soon as 50,000 people maybe get resettled, another 50,000 people are displaced again. And these people go into the dense forest. It's the second largest rainforest in the world, and they die from the elements.
Yeah. Just so people get the picture, can you tell us a little more about these militias and their tactics? I'm thinking of a conversation that you and another writer had at a bar, about the Mai Mai and the Lendu.
A lot of their tactics are cannibalistic. They'll kill their people and then slice open their bodies and eat the hearts and livers of their dead right on the battle floor. And this is done for intimidation and also ritualistic. You know, they think that if they eat the heart of their enemy, then it makes them stronger. And it adds to the kind of evil of it. And when you see it, it's pretty chilling.
Well, as you said, its effectiveness is superb. The exchange I was speaking of goes something like this. The UN is saying the Mai Mai are sporting fetuses around their necks, he said. Oh, lovely. I hear the Lendu wear human kidneys on their bandoliers. I think I saw it once.
Right.
Have you seen this? I mean, because you have to wonder how much of this is just, you know, jungle myth and how much is true.
I did see that. I did see little child soldiers with, you know, dried body parts on their bandoliers, and I inquired what they were, and they said they were kidneys. This was in Bunia in 2003 when a lot of this massacring was taking place. They're child soldiers. They're about 14, 15 years old, some as young as 8. And, you know, what they do is they dress up in women's clothes. They wear these punk rock sort of yellow wigs, and they paint their fingernails red, and they wear these kind of sequence prom dresses, and they walk around with their machetes and their Kalashnikovs, and it's bone chilling, you know. And it's but they think that it's a battle dress. It's fright camos and stuff like that. For they think it stops bullets from piercing them, but it's also intimidation as well.
You'd talked to the man in charge of the UN peacekeeping force, Major General Patrick Kamart. He's the Dutch general in charge of 4,000 peacekeepers, and he tells you he's losing sleep. He can't stop thinking about what's happening in the forest.
Right.
They just seem the UN seems no match for the militias.
The UN could do it very easily if they became more aggressive, and they are doing that. And you know, I do kind of bag the UN a bit in my article, but they're the only ones in there doing anything. And so,
well, I was going to say, because his plight, Major General Patrick Kamart's, seems similar to that of Romeo Dallaire, the UN general who was in charge of overseeing the peacekeeping forces in Rwanda. He begged for more troops and didn't get them.
Right. Kamara really would love those troops to get in there, and I think he's doing his best. But at the same time, you know, he's lost about 12 peacekeepers, well, about 19 now, because in combat. You know, he had 9 Bangladeshi peacekeepers who were ambushed and slaughtered and their bodies mutilated back last year. And then just January of this year, the UN brought in these special Guatemalan special forces officers, and, you know, because they were trained in jungle fighting. And you know, these Guatemalan peacekeepers were ambushed and killed. And so, I mean, that's his plight. That's what he has to deal with. And he doesn't want to become another, you know, Dallaire or the commander who was in charge of Somalia when these troops were killed in that peacekeeping mission back in 93. So, I mean, it's a very daunting task for him because he has so much territory to cover. And it's so dense, and it's logistically, it's almost impossible for him to get in there. And you have troops who know nothing about this because he's using mainly Bangladeshi and Indian troops. And, you know, they don't know that terrain, and they're no match for these Hutu rebel fighters who've lived there all their lives.
Brian Mueller, his recent article, Congo's Daily Blood, Ruminations from a Failed State, appears in this month's edition of Harper's Magazine. And just ahead, we're going to ask Brian, what can be done, if anything, in Congo? And this note later in the program, why some people think the U.S. is sending the signal that illegal immigrants with brains are not as welcome as illegal immigrants with brawn. Much more coming up here and now. With Brian Mueller, a journalist who was in Congo in 2003 and then again in 2005, covering the conflict which has already claimed the lives of more than 4 million people over just the last 5 years. And Brian, I know this is tough for people to hear, but that's your point. You want them to hear it. You write about something that happened in the town of Bunia in Congo in 2003. You and everyone else there knew there was going to be a slaughter because the Ugandan army, which had been occupying the town, was pulling out, and these rogue ragtag militias were just on the outskirts waiting to go in. Describe what happened. You eventually left the town as well, thinking that much of the world just doesn't care what happens in Congo.
Yeah, they don't. I was in Bunia in 2003, and the Ugandans were pulling out of that town. They were the last occupying army left over from the war, and everybody knew, including the UN, that as soon as they pulled out, there was going to be a massive bloody power vacuum that happened. And that's what did happen, and I was able to evacuate myself on the last plane out with the Ugandan general that afternoon. And that night, the Lindu militia came in and started slaughtering Hema. They'd pull them out of their houses, take them into the street and shoot them in the head, and then they would, you know, kind of mutilate their bodies and do various things that I just described earlier. And, the several weeks I was there before, they would hit the town every day and people would turn up dead. There was gunshots at night. It would slowly, you know, I'd pack my bags every night before I went to sleep just in case I had to run out. I changed hotels about four or five times. I was completely encapsulated with paranoia. And then, you know, I was the only reporter in that town at that point, and I wasn't filing daily at that point. And then when I evacuated myself, the town fell, and I was living in Nairobi, Kenya at the time. And, you know, the BBC and all these different places would have little reports about it. But we knew what was happening, and we knew why it was happening, and we knew that the UN had been there, and the UN had been warned about this daily. And, it was just shameful to me. That's what it was. It was, like, shameful that nothing was happening. We went back 10 days later, and, you know, that's when the flood of reporters started coming in, and then it got noticed a little bit more. But during that period, you know, it's like we all can report after the fact, but, you know, before the fact, it's like, you know, look at the genocide in Rwanda. I mean, that's a case in point. So.
Well, you just said we knew why it was happening. In that one particular instance, you knew why it was happening. But in general, you know, you're trying to figure out why doesn't anybody cover this more. And you say because no one really understands what drives someone to behead a 5-year-old girl with a farm tool or wipe out an entire village. It's easier to pretend these things don't exist.
Yeah, it is much easier. You know, that after that time in Bunia in 2003, you know, I came back to New York for a year and nobody, you know, I'd sit around in bars and talk about it with my friends and people's eyes would just glaze over and they'd be like, man, you know, that sounds really hardcore, but, you know, where's Congo, you know? And so I, you know, I went back and, you know, 2005 as the AP correspondent there and I guess I was looking for something, and I was looking to try to find answers. I don't know, that sounds a bit cliche, but I was looking to find answers and try to answer some things about myself and about that place. And you know, and you think there's, you know, this place is so huge and it's so dense in every sort of way. And there's so many forces at play there. You don't know why. I mean, I say in my story, you know, a gunshot, you know, there could be a little burp of gunfire and it would displace 25,000 people. And these people will march for miles and they'll go down in this little bitty remote valley and they just start dying there of like cholera and stuff like that. And you don't know why that happens. It's confusing and confounding. And I'm still confused about it today.
But share some of what you learned, because as you also write, the dead are still with us, meaning you, and it's still up to us to sort them out. I'm wondering, you know, how are they still with you? But also, how do you sort it out? What do you think should happen in Congo?
That's a great question. I mean, I left and I didn't know that answer. I don't think I know that answer now. I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday. It's like, what could you do? Do you send in Marines? You know, I think the answers aren't as sexy as we like them to be. I think the answers are more having to deal with, you know, a solid government and a corrupt free government and connecting markets. You know, Congo, there's no roads. There's no railroads. You know, fix these roads, connect these markets in the east, have people making money. And, you know, there won't be so much room for militias to come in and take control. Young kids won't go and join the militias when they can find a job. People in Congo are really resourceful and they're very, you know, all they want is their dignity. And I think, you know, that's and everybody. I mean, everybody, every human being wants some dignity and they want to work. And in Congo, they've been without it for you know, entire lifetimes. And that's I think that's the saddest thing when you go there, when you see somebody who, you know, is an able-bodied person. He really wants to work and he wants to make some money and he wants to look at his family and, he wants to be a man. And he can't have it. And he's dependent on the UN or dependent on militia or whatever. And I think once you incorporate that in these people's lives and help them with that, you know, I'm not saying that's the answer, but I think it'll do some good.
And you've said more UN troops, African Union troops. Should there be a world coalition? I'm thinking of the Balkans. Should there be something like that, or does it have to come from, you know, the continent?
I think that would be a good idea. They've talked about it in Congo. They've talked a lot about it. They talked about not, you know, African troops coming in there and pushing out the Hutu rebels who are still pretty prominent there. The UN is doing a decent job, but it's just there's so much politics in that. And so, you know, they can't, it's peace enforcing. They go in there with big attack helicopters And they actually do. They, you know, they shoot at these people and they kill them. And that's the point that we're at. I mean, you can debate all you want about, is that moral for, you know, a world body who's supposed to stay neutral to do that? But yes, you have to do that. Because these people, if they don't do that, then they're going to go and slaughter, you know, 300 people tomorrow. I mean, it just happens. But, you know, I still think that's kind of a Band-Aid. I think you have to start deeper than that. And how deep that goes, I'm not even sure. So.
Brian Mueller, freelance journalist, his recent article entitled Congo's Daily Blood, Ruminations from a Failed State, appears in this month's edition of Harper's Magazine. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, post-polio syndrome. On the 51st anniversary of the discovery of the polio vaccines, we'll go to a reunion of polio survivors, many discovering their symptoms are worse or coming back after going away. Also, wildly popular Israeli musician Eden Rahel with his fusion of pop and traditional Ethiopian folk. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR.
Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is calling the recent wave of pro-immigration rallies bigger than the civil rights movement. Richardson says the protests pressure Congress to pass immigration reform that will bring undocumented workers out of the shadows. But some critics say that instead of focusing immigration reform on day laborers and farm workers, the U.S. should be easing entry for foreign engineers and physicists. Here Now listener Virginia Salvo of Bulgaria agrees. She's a PhD student at Johns Hopkins University, and she asks, why is she less worthy of green cards than low-paid laborers?
Both my husband and I went to school here. We have student loans here. We use scholarships, American scholarships, and I really don't see how it would be good for the United States if we were to leave, because I think the United States would profit very much if they made it easier for people like us to stay here.
Well, Michael Lind of the New America Foundation agrees. He and Stephen Clemens wrote a New York Times op-ed piece this past weekend called How to Lose the Brain Race. And Michael Lind joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Hi.
Well, Virginia calls for more green cards or permanent resident visas for students. Meanwhile, you write that in the failed Senate bill, Senator Dianne Feinstein calls for increasing fees for foreign students applying to American universities. You see that as a problem. Why?
Well, the immigration reforms that are being debated now in Congress have a perverse effect. They discourage skilled and educated people from immigrating to the United States. And at the same time, they reward cheap labor agribusiness companies with low-wage, unskilled labor of a kind which is overly abundant in the United States. So the message we're sending to the world is, we don't want your brains. Send us your brawn.
Well, a couple thoughts here. First of all, Senator Feinstein says that foreigners are keeping U.S. students out of otherwise available slots in colleges, and that's why she wanted to raise the fees on foreign students coming to universities. And to what you just said, many people would say there aren't the workers to pick the strawberries and wash the dishes in kitchens in America.
Well, there would be plenty of workers to do all of these low-wage occupations if wages were higher. When low-wage industries claim that there's a labor shortage, what they really mean is there's a shortage of American workers willing to work at these jobs for the low wages they pay. If you raised the wages, then either Americans would do those jobs or businesses would have an incentive to invest in labor-saving machinery. For example, if you look at agriculture, in Australia, where wages are higher, a lot of the agricultural harvesting is done by machines rather than by poor human beings.
In fact, you point to Australia and other countries as being way ahead of the U.S. in how they treat foreigners coming into the country, specifically the highly skilled workers. How is it different?
Well, Australia, Canada, and now Britain have a points system. That is, the points are awarded in favor of potential immigrants if they are proficient in English, if they have advanced education in their home countries, or for that matter, in the destination country, if they have particular skills that are needed. And in some cases, if they are young, so that they will contribute a great deal economically before retiring. The United States has a very outmoded system dating back to the 1960s, where most immigrants, the largest category is family reunification of immigrants who are already here. And in practice, this means largely low-skilled, low-wage workers. On top of that, there are refugees. There is some employment-based immigration, and there's also the H-1B visa program and similar guest worker programs.
Let's explain that. That allows foreigners with special skills to work in the U.S. for up to 6 years, and it attracts a lot of software programmers and engineers, and it was cut back from 195,000 visas a year to 65,000 after 9/11. What do you think are the consequences of that policy?
Well, according to the tech industry, it's harmful, and I agree with that. We do need more scientists, engineers, physicists from other countries, both who study abroad and then bring their skills here and who study in the United States as students. The problem with the H-1B program and similar guest worker programs is that it creates a two-tier labor market in the United States. That is, the guest workers lack the full civil rights and political rights and labor rights of American citizens. They are usually dependent on their employers in order to remain in the United States. And so this gives employers an incentive not to hire American citizen workers in order to hire these guest workers. The solution to that is not to ban foreign workers. It's to allow them to come here under a point system like the ones in Britain, Canada, and Australia so that they're not essentially indentured servants of particular corporations, but can compete with American workers on an equal basis.
But a point system, isn't that immigration elitism?
Well, the difference between high-wage immigrants and low-wage immigrants is twofold. To begin with, the skilled immigrants tend to contribute more in taxes than they take out from society. It's the reverse with unskilled immigrants who are very heavily dependent on public services and on welfare. At the same time, unskilled immigrants tend to compete with poor Americans for a fixed number of low-wage service sector jobs, and as well as jobs in agriculture and manufacturing. By contrast, educated immigrants, particularly entrepreneurs and inventors, can generate many, many jobs in addition to their own. If you look at the history of Silicon Valley, which was largely built by immigrant labor, you see that it's not a zero-sum game.
You point out that the H-1B visa workers, the foreign workers, take a lower salary, and their employers know that, and so do American students. They don't want to compete with those workers coming in, so maybe they quit, you know, before they even get into the field. How would a point system like Australia has change that?
Well, a point system would be far superior to the H-1B visa program from the point of view of Americans competing with foreign immigrants for jobs. The H-1B program makes the guest workers completely dependent on their employers. They can't quit without risking deportation. So that means that they're probably more likely to accept lower wages and to work longer hours. And therefore, employers prefer these H-1B visa workers in many cases to American workers. Now, if the same skilled immigrants from India, China, and other countries came to the U.S. under a point system, they would not have to work for any particular employer, so they would not be intimidated into taking lower wages and working longer hours. And at the same time, they would be competing with American students and workers on a level playing field. So that's why we think that the H-1B program ought to be abolished in favor of a British and Canadian and Australian-style point system that will level the playing field between skilled Americans and skilled immigrants.
Michael, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Provocative thoughts from Michael Lind. He's a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and he recently wrote in the New York Times that America is in danger of losing the brain race. It's a story of the struggle within the immigrant community between high-skilled and low-skilled workers. Well, still to come, a new Frontline documentary goes looking for Tank Man, the lone protester who stood up to the Chinese military in the aftermath of Tiananmen Square. You're listening to Here and Now. 15 seconds in this country, someone is the victim of domestic violence, and often so are their pets. In fact, statistics show one in four people in an abusive relationship will not leave because of concern for what will happen to their pets if they do. Well, now a new law in Maine, believed to be the first of its kind, allows judges to include pets in protection orders when someone leaves an abusive relationship. And abusers might also face fines or jail time for violating those orders. Joining us on the line from Maine is Susan Walsh, who testified on behalf of this legislation. And Susan, I know you had a personal story to tell. You say you stayed in a marriage for 12 years rather than leave because of concern for your pets.
Yes.
Yeah. What happened?
Basically, I knew I could go down to my parents with the kids, but I also had dogs and cats as well as farm animals to consider, and I knew he'd been abusive towards them in the past and had killed a number of animals and used the threat of violence against them to keep me around.
Right. Really killed them? Killed,
yes. And in one instance, he went out into the barn. We had two sheep. He went out there and shot them both.
And we understand he also ran over your dog.
He ran over my dog. I had two dogs, border collies, and Cricket, the mother, and Katie did, her daughter. And Katie did, I was very attached to. And he ran her down in the driveway while I was at my parents'.
Well, you know, and you soon found out that you were not alone in this, and the studies are amazing. According to the Latham Foundation, in New Jersey, animal abuse was found in 88% of families under investigation for child abuse. 71% of pet-owning women in a Utah shelter said their abusers had also harmed or killed their pets.
Yeah.
How did it feel to find out that, in fact, there is, according to many people, experts in this, a connection between pet abuse and domestic abuse?
It was scary. I at first I didn't really make the connection that it was all one and the same. But knowing that there was a connection made me feel like I was a little less crazy, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That this was was part of the beast.
Well, now, some states, California, Connecticut, Ohio, encourage cross-reporting between agencies involving human and pet abuse so that these two different agencies can talk to each other. And we have this new law in Maine in which, a pet can get the same kind of, restraint against an abusive spouse, for instance, as you can get. Does this help you, or is it too late for you?
Well, it doesn't affect my situation right now. I am divorced, but it's wonderful to know that this protection is there for other people who might find themselves in a similar situation.
Hmm. Susan Walsh, some of us get this, but what do you say to people who'd say, how could you not leave an abusive husband because of an animal, because of fear of what he would do to an animal?
As I said in my testimony down in Augusta, we love our animals, and we take our responsibility towards them very seriously. They're members of our family. We love them and want to protect them. There's a reason I call my pets, my children or my babies. And somebody asks me how many children I have, I say, well, four-legged or two-legged. One thing that was paralyzing for me in the end was trying to set up, I was trying to set up a triage of sorts in my head for the animals, which animals, if I could flee, which animals could I take with me, and which ones would he kill first, which ones could I find a home for, and just trying to sort that all out. We had a lot of animals at the time, and it got to be overwhelming.
Well, we hear one in the background that obviously made it out on Susan's ark, the rooster there.
Yes, I got four roosters out there. There's Bart, and there's Ginger, who is, I'm probably going to have to change his name to Fred.
Well, Maine resident Susan Walsh, who testified on behalf of a new law to extend protection orders to pets and animals who are caught in the crossfire of domestic violence, and she eventually left an abusive home. Susan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. We'll be right back. month, China's president, Hu Jintao, is scheduled to visit the U.S. The agenda no doubt will be dominated by discussions of trade and China's military ambitions. But back in 1989, the conversation about China was focused squarely on human rights, as the world learned about a massive protest in Tiananmen Square and a massacre of Chinese citizens by the tanks and troops sent to the square. Actual figures of how many people died vary from 800 to 3,000. Well, at that time, one image captured the world's attention, that of a lone man standing in front of a column of tanks.
No one around him. He was all on his own with his shopping bag in his hand. He climbed on top of the tank, banged on the lid, said, "Get out of my city. You're not wanted here." We don't know exactly what he said, but it's clear that's what he wanted to say.
Whatever happened to that man? Well, a new Frontline special called The Tank Man attempts to answer that question. It airs tonight on PBS stations around the country. And filmmaker Anthony Thomas joins us from London with more. Welcome.
Hello there.
Let's take people back to that time. It was the spring of 1989. It began as a student protest, protesting against corruption and for freedom of speech. It was at the same time that the Soviet Union was crumbling. The Chinese government was very nervous. But it immediately grew into a very different kind of protest, didn't it?
That's right. It very, very quickly, citizens were involved, you know, first of all in Beijing and right through the country. I mean, at least 300 cities and all classes of people. I mean, it's amazing. The army was out there demonstrating, and it did look as though that regime was about to topple.
Now, seeing the pictures again, it brings tears to your eyes to see the hope, you know, that was initial. And then, of course, the government declared martial law, ordered tanks into Tiananmen Square.
It went in two phases. The first attempt to send troops into Beijing, the citizens just stopped them and beseeched the soldiers to turn round, and the troops withdrew. And then there was a 10-day interlude, and then a different force arrived with heavy armor.
And fired upon the people trying to put up blockades, made its way into Tiananmen Square. Just horrific sounds and video of that night. The lights turned out, the tanks possibly rolling over people. But ultimately, the students decided to leave peacefully.
Correct.
And then the next wave of massacres were the parents who were coming to the square the next day trying to find their children.
There were terrible rumors going around Beijing. Rumors that thousands of students had died, which is not true, and these distraught parents came to see what was happening. The square was completely surrounded with tanks, and as they approached the tanks, they were ordered to withdraw. They didn't withdraw, and they were fired on.
Then all the people would realize that their guns were pointed at them, and they'd go running past the hotel. And then the soldiers would fire in their backs. I felt like I was watching some terrible opera.
And a lot of people went down. 30, 40, 50 people are knocked down. Everybody else ran away. I'm lying in the grass thinking, this is the worst thing ever. This is hell.
Then, as another observer says, the tanks left in an obscene dance, he puts it. They're dancing almost down this wide street right in front of the hotel where all the journalists are.
Yep.
And that's when the tank man appeared.
That's right.
Who was he?
We don't think he was a student. This is only an intelligent guess. He was just carrying a couple of shopping bags. Students tended to be in groups, and they wouldn't have been going around with shopping bags. He was very young by his movements. His body language is somebody probably in their late teens, early 20s. And beyond that, we don't know. I think what's so tragic is, well, first of all, I think it says so much about China that somebody who was so much at the forefront of the world's attention can disappear like that. But I think also the sad thing, as I think the film shows, is that some Western journalists invented stories about him.
Well, there's that. But also you remind us that just, you know, one picture in particular gave us an image of him. In fact, the photographer hid the roll of film in a toilet in a hotel room,
right,
knowing
yeah.
the security forces were going to come in. He went back later, and as he said, thankfully nobody flushed. It was still there. The image made many of us think that it was a very static moment, that he just stood there. But in fact, he hopped up on the tanks.
Yeah.
He hopped back and forth to try to block them. Eventually, people came out, and it seeming to say, "What, you're insane, get out of here," and took him away.
Therein is the great mystery. Mm. Were those concerned citizens who were trying to persuade him to get out of the way of trouble, or were those security pleas?
Well, fast forward, the government response to Tiananmen was to couple repression of political reform with encouragement of economic growth. And in this present day, there is a great deal more wealth in China.
Yes.
But as you point out, a greater divide between the haves and the have-nots.
That's right.
One wonders, did you come to the conclusion that that might lead to another Tiananmen Square?
It's possible. In 2004, there were 74,000 uprisings in China, demonstrations and uprising. The latest figure for 2005 is 87,000. Some of those were just classic demonstrations, but a lot of them had to be put down with force. And as one person says in the film, China is a land of 1,000 earthquake faults. There is so much resentment. I think China is on a knife edge.
Well, and yet there's so much repression, which is why so many here in the U.S. were enraged when they heard that U.S. companies such as Yahoo and Google were actually bowing to Chinese demands to either repress a free flow of information or hand over information about who uses the Internet. If you type in Tiananmen Square into Google in China, you won't see any images of the Tank Man.
No.
And you actually found, you interviewed several students from Beijing University and found that many of them didn't know who he was.
That's right. And that's what's so tragic. Beijing University was the nerve center of the student uprising that inspired the whole democracy movement in 1989. And to actually go back there and to speak to four intelligent undergraduates, and they were mystified by the photograph.
But do you think that's true, Anthony, or do you think that they felt they had to say that?
No, I study that very, very carefully. I mean, this is a very sensitive picture as far as the authorities are concerned. I mean, I was warned because I brought those copies of the picture into the country, and I was warned that if it was found in my baggage, I'd be in deep trouble.
Mm.
Now, those young people, if they'd known that image, I believe somewhere there would have been a sort of frisson. There would have been a look from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
There would have been a slight shock. There wasn't. The first answer was whispered. It was not for me to hear. It was whispered. It looks like some military ceremony. She was genuinely confused. I mean, I looked at that footage again and again. I didn't want to give a misleading impression. And I just don't think that they had a clue what it was.
So, in effect, the Chinese government has been able to erase, at least for a part of the population, history. Given that, what conclusion do you come to, Anthony Thomas? Did the Tank Man have an effect if, in fact, he's been erased?
Well, this is a very big question. You see, if you go to Beijing, something traumatic happened in that city, if I may say so, comparable to Twin Towers in its terms of its violence and its loss of life, and you're not allowed to speak about it. There's no moment you have where you can grieve. You have to bottle that up inside you. And I think that's a terrible imposition.
And yet, as far as how what impact the Tank Man had, at the time, his image went around the world and sparked other movements.
Right. That's right. And it was shown briefly in China. They put it in their propaganda film, which came out explaining the events, as an example of the Red Army's restraint. I mean, the fact that the tank driver hadn't just driven on and crushed him. Well, it didn't have that effect, and they realized that, and that picture was never shown again.
Anthony Thomas's frontline film, The Tank Man, appears tonight on PBS stations around the country. Anthony Thomas, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And by the way, that's the music of Tan Dun. It's called Silk Road. On a day when we have a lot to think about. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news.